left with Sabrina Jacobs, African-American producer at KPFA. So I kind of stitched those together, hopefully. And got a particularly long Breaking the Sound Barrier segment with Amy Goodman today. And it's about coronavirus, COVID. Kind of a slightly longer than typical commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal, political prisoner, in my opinion, and he's getting a retrial. How about that? Uh-oh. Best laid plans. I've got an infinite loop here going on, and we'll see what we can do about that. There's always something. Got Jeremy Scahill with a rather long thought piece, and the latest debate, which I was going to watch, turns out it was on Mardi Gras, so I didn't. Oh my. I'm still getting this infinite loop effect of some kind here on my Dropbox files. And this is a new one on me. I've never experienced this before. Brick Collist has a little bit on black history, black thought. I was just struck by how in the African-American community, Forced into Glory, the book by Laron Bennett, late great, was a long time with Ebony magazine in Chicago. That book is a bestseller in the African-American community, but people don't know it from, I don't know what, the Iliad or elsewhere. Well, I've only thought that I should probably reboot Firefox and see if I can get to it. I do have these items up on Google, but I'm not as used to playing it, and Google, it's harder to play directly into it. Let's see if this helps. But extemporizing. I do have a little musical bumper. And, oh, well, it looks like we might be getting there. Attended a great show by a Franco-American artist. Can I say that? French-American. Her mother's French. Studied both here and in McGill in Montreal. Laura Driscoll was in town, and she has a little bumper for one of my favorite tunes, which is called ECMT Intro, ECMT Blues. That's ECM Records, and the T is for either tetrad or tetrachord. Tetrad, I guess, would work. I don't play a lot of music that comes from businesses and CDs and anything like that, because we're supposed to log it if it's more than 30 seconds. So she has a nice bumper with my favorite tune, and it's under that. Oh, I'm back into a loop here. Uh-oh. I don't know what to make of this. This is a new one on me. Okay. Go home, it says. Oh, okay. Okay, well, here's that tune, just a little bumper, so I guess it's a nice nice little sample of her stylizing. And not the players that she had last night, but she's on a tour, and she'll be in at Upfront in Bloomington, Illinois next weekend. So if people listening out in the western regions or people want to drive to Bloomington, might want to check that out. Already 4 minutes in, so things are not going according to plan. But here's that little musical intro, and it looks like I'll be getting to the usual features and not just talking for an hour, which I guess I could possibly sustain. I do have coffee here. Mumia is talking about Delbert Africa. I think he's the last of the MOVE folks. If you don't remember that, Google it. Look for some alternative views of the subject. It was a collective in Philadelphia that got bombed in started a fire that burned out a whole area. Maybe it was at the behest of developers or something. Well, the device was on continuous. You air shifters out there know what that means. It was supposed to play the little bumper. It was hard to stop that, too. That was a beautiful tune. I did put up a Facebook video of it. I don't know how steady I was. And it's a public file, so one can find it. Even if you don't indulge in Facebook, it's worth checking her out. All right, let's get back on schedule here a little bit and listen to commentary from Mumi Abu-Jamal, who has part two of his book out with a co-author. He's been busy. But this is about somebody we knew in Philly when he was a stringer for WHYY, Where Fresh Air Comes From. I don't know if they've ever done a show about his circumstance, even though he actually made it to an appeal.
Delbert Walks. For Delbert Africa, a member of the MOVE organization, his imprisonment for his membership in MOVE has led to what the late Nelson Mandela called a long walk to freedom. On August 8, 1978, Delbert was beaten brutally, senseless. His jawbone was broken. To make matters worse, and to add insult to injury, when several cops were prosecuted for this vicious, brutal beating of Delbert, a Philadelphia judge would willy-nilly dismiss everything, all of the charges, and he dismissed the jury, which was imported from a Pennsylvania county, one of the whitest rural counties in the state, and issue an acquittal despite videotape evidence. The judge, incredibly, writes an opinion that justifies Delbert's beating by citing to his muscularity, I kid you not. For Delbert was apparently well built, and the poor cops were frightened that he had so much musculature. Shortly after this beating occurred, and was denied by police at a press conference later that day in City Hall, it was broadcast all across the city of Philadelphia. At a public meeting in Center City a few days later, a popular black politician, the late city councilman Lucian Blackwell, told a crowd of blacks that, this is a direct quote, Delbert Africa is one of the greatest black men who have ever lived. I'm told that Delbert's beating can be seen today on YouTube, so check it out. Today, Delbert Africa is free after 42 years in the joint. He is free to tell his own story now from Imprison Nation. This is Mumia Abu Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Paging Dr. Trump. First, do no harm. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump and Larry Kudlow, the director of Trump's National Economic Council, aren't doctors, but they play them on TV. As the coronavirus epidemic spirals into a pandemic, causing a plunge in the U.S. stock market, Trump and Kudlow, a former CNBC TV host, are cynically spreading disinformation about the contagion.
We have contained this. We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight.
That's Trump advisor Larry Kudlow speaking on his old network CNBC Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, Trump tweeted, low ratings, fake news, MSDNC, Comcast, and CNN are doing everything possible to make the coronavirus look as bad as possible, including panicking markets. USA in great shape, exclamation point, the president of the United States tweeted. These statements directly contradicted a dire warning issued earlier that day by Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. She said on a press call,
the global novel coronavirus situation is rapidly evolving and expanding. There has been a lot of news coverage about community spread in a few countries since the last time we talked. This means that cases of COVID-19 are appearing without a known source of exposure. Locations with reported community spread now include Hong Kong, Iran, Italy, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, and Thailand. Community spread is often a trigger to begin implementing new strategies tailored to local circumstances that blunt the impact of disease and can slow the spread of virus. The fact that this virus has caused illness, including illness resulting in death, and sustained person-to-person spread is concerning. These factors meet two of the criteria of a pandemic. As community spread is detected in more and more countries, the world moves closer towards meeting the third criteria, worldwide spread of the new virus.
Referring to a coronavirus outbreak in the U.S., Dr. Messonnier said,
it's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness.
As of Wednesday night, there were more than 82,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus infections globally and 2,800 deaths, as reported by a team at Johns Hopkins University. Most of these cases were in China, but the virus has been detected on every continent save Antarctica, with deaths also reported in Iran, Italy, France, Japan, the Philippines, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and aboard the Diamond Princess cruise ship quarantined in Yokohama, Japan. One of the most critical actions a government can take to prevent or to limit a pandemic is to clearly communicate accurate information to as wide a population as possible. That's probably why Li Wenliang, a 34-year-old ophthalmologist at Wuhan Central Hospital, China, shared his observations on the outbreak as he was treating patients on December 30th. The Chinese government censored his posts. He was ordered to a police station to sign a confession that he had made untrue statements on social media. At least seven others were similarly harassed. Days later, Li became sick with coronavirus and was hospitalized. He died on February 6th. His death sparked widespread criticism of the Chinese government for suppressing news of the epidemic's severity and for punishing a courageous whistleblower. The 47-year-old director of the Wuhan hospital died of the same viral infection not long after. China mounted a massive response, building a 1,000-bed hospital in less than a week, and locked down Wuhan and other huge cities, quarantining up to 100 million people in China. In the U.S., as the number of confirmed coronavirus cases increases, our preparedness, or lack thereof, is causing concern. Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist Lori Garrett spoke on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
Where we are right now is that everybody is recognizing, oops, it was a big mistake by the Trump administration to obliterate the entire infrastructure of pandemic response that the Obama administration had created. Why did he do it? Well, it certainly wasn't about the money, because it wasn't a heavily funded program. It was certainly because it was Obama's program.
And explain, you're talking about the unit within the Centers for Disease Control.
No, we're talking about something much vaster than that. It was a special division inside the National Security Council, a special division inside of the Department of Homeland Security that Bozo was talking from, and collaborating centers in HHS headquarters in Washington, the Office of Global Health Affairs, and the Commerce Department, Treasury Department. But what Obama understood dealing with Ebola in 2014 is that any American response had to be an all of government response, that there were so many agencies overlapping and they all had a little piece of the puzzle in the case of a pandemic.
Currently, no coherent structure exists in the United States to address a rapidly spreading deadly pandemic. Instead, a hodgepodge of unqualified Trump loyalists are on the front line, with thankfully career professionals at the Centers for Disease Control and National Institutes of Health trying their best to protect the public despite a dysfunctional White House. At a Senate hearing Tuesday, Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy seemed incredulous with acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf's lack of preparation. Kennedy grilled Wolf on everything from respirators to infection rates.
Mr. Secretary,
my budget supports,
you're supposed to keep us safe.
My budget supports the men and women
you're
of the Department
Secretary
of Homeland Security.
You're the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes, sir.
And you can't tell me if we have enough respirators.
What I would tell you is that the budget, my budget, our operations are focused not only on the men and women of DHS, making sure they're protected to do their jobs, to screen individuals coming in. We're working with HHS, CDC, and their budgets
the answer,
to ensure that they have enough medical equipment.
Do we have enough face masks?
We, for the Department of Homeland Security, we
I'm
do.
Not asking for the Department of Homeland Security.
Are you looking?
I'm asking for the American people.
For the entire American public?
Yes.
No, I would say probably not.
Okay, how short are we?
I don't have that number offhand, Senator. I will get that for you.
Okay, but I want to be sure I understand. Somebody,
yes, sir,
is doing modeling.
Yes, sir.
On how many cases were anticipated.
You're yes,
just
sir.
Not aware of.
You're asking me a number of medical questions. That
I'm asking
CDC
you questions
and HHS
because you're Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and you're supposed to keep us safe.
Yes, sir.
And you need to know the answers to these questions.
And
how far away are we from getting a vaccine?
In several months.
Well, that's not what we just heard testimony about.
Okay.
Who's on first here?
HHS is
What's
the federal agency for the coronavirus response. I would refer you to the CDC on specific questions.
Mr. Secretary,
questions.
I'm going to hush here. You're supposed to keep us safe, and the American people deserve some straight answers on the coronavirus. And
Senator,
I'm not getting them from you.
At a Wednesday evening news conference at the White House, Trump again assured the public that everything was going to be fine as long as people wash their hands and avoid touching doorknobs. He also announced Vice President Mike Pence would coordinate the federal response, citing the Indiana model of public health Pence implemented as governor.
I'm going to be announcing exactly right now that I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge. And Mike will be working with the professionals and doctors and everybody else that's working. The team is brilliant. I spent a lot of time with the team over the last couple of weeks, but they're totally brilliant and we're doing really well, and Mike is going to be in charge and Mike will report back to me.
What experience was Trump touting? Between 2011 and 2015, first as an Indiana Congress member, then as the governor, Pence oversaw the defunding of Planned Parenthood, as well as the shutdown of needle exchange programs. After an outbreak of HIV infections, Pence was forced to back down. His moralistic prescriptions, canceling sensible public health policies, caused lasting harm. What can we expect from him now? Here's a message for President Trump and his cronies. This is not about the stock market or your reelection. The coronavirus epidemic or pandemic demands a concerted, professional, fully funded global public health response. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yay, Senator Kennedy. That's a hard thing for me to say. That's the Kennedy from Louisiana. And he started with respirators instead of just asking about masks. I don't think the U.S. needs to build a hospital like they did in Wuhan in China, but they could repurpose some of these empty malls and big box stores all across the country into some kind of medical clinic or a longer term stay and get some of those respirators that Kennedy was asking about, because I guess it's a very debilitating form of pneumonia that comes on with the COVID. All right, I don't want to yak too much because I've already had 5 minutes gone to some bizarre technical detail. I think we'll get to the commentary with Scahill. A lot of little snippets well put together, it seems to me. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. He says he doesn't endorse anybody. I believe him. But he does cut through. It's basically looking at the media campaign against Sanders and democratic socialism or any kind, any flavor. Yeah. There is a little musical humorous vignette, and I think I've vetted it properly. Gina will be in to do continuity. Hopefully everything's going well at her abode. She'll be able to make it over, and we'll have behind the news with Doug Henwood. It might be an older evergreen one, since I'll be looking for that if he doesn't have a fresh one for the pledge drive time at KPFA. He's hosted, though he lives in Brooklyn, he's stationed, and the show is hosted out of KPFA. There's a story there, but I won't go into it. Here's from the latest Intercepted, which I mentioned has a pretty long interview. I haven't heard all of it yet with Jesse Jackson. Despite his Parkinson, his voice is pretty strong. And I wanted to mention also Palast frequency. He's a Chicago native originally, who we'll be getting to in the second half hour, roughly. has a good relationship. They've shown the film Best Democracy Money Can Buy all over Chicagoland, and again, mostly in the African-American community. But that's one of the points that Palace dwells on in the interview with the Rude Awakening segment. Again, the KPFA's in pledge drive mode, and they really need to raise some big bucks. I need to vote in the bylaws election, actually. Reminding myself here on the air to participate in community media.
Bernie Sanders leads the Democratic field in national polls. He's the front runner.
You're making a lot of people nervous.
Is that a bad thing?
Bernie Sanders has been arguing that everyone can have health care, education, and a decent paying job.
Let's use the federal government to protect the interests of working families.
Isn't that a dangerous message for Democrats?
Blah, 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 blah. Liar.
And that's just one of Bernie Sanders' many proposals. There's also free public college, cancellation of all student debt, a federal job guarantee, and a Green New Deal to rapidly reduce carbon emissions.
How are you going to pay for this?
Through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation.
How would that even work?
We have a tax on wealth, as you well know, Anderson.
Do you know how much, though? I mean, do you have a price tag?
Oh, boy. How are you going to pay for that?
Are you getting mad?
It's taxes on billionaires, you know? How are you going to pay for over $750 billion on military spending? How are you going to pay for $1 trillion in tax breaks to the 1% in large corporations, which was what Trump did?
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 118 of Intercepted.
Can Americans trust that a Democratic Socialist president will not give authoritarians a free pass?
I have opposed authoritarianism all over the world, and I was really amazed at what Mayor Bloomberg just said a moment ago. He said that the Chinese government is responsive to the Politburo. But who the hell is the Politburo responsive to? Who elects the Politburo? You got a real dictatorship there? Of course you have a dictatorship in Cuba. What I said is what Barack Obama said in terms of Cuba. That Cuba made progress on education. Yes, I think. Really? Really?
Yes,
literacy
because there's
programs
no comparing
are bad.
Those two.
What Barack Obama
Barack
said
Obama
is they made great progress on education and health care. That was Barack Obama.
I talked to Barack Obama.
Excuse me. Occasionally, it might be a good idea to be honest about American foreign policy. And that includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Iran. And when dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans, do something good, huh, you acknowledge that. But you don't have trade love letters.
Mr. President,
this is 2020.
There are a few patterns in the media and political discourse in this country that I want to take a few moments to address. And they have to do with the way that the Bernie Sanders campaign is discussed on the airwaves of corporate media outlets and publications, as well as among the elite class of the Democratic Party establishment, and also among some of the so-called Never Trump Republicans who have made an alliance with these Democratic elites. In short, what we are witnessing is the beginnings of the cataclysmic meltdown that will occur in various sectors of the U.S. political class, elite class in the United States, if Bernie Sanders wins the majority of delegates in the Democratic primary.
I'm reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940, and the general, Renault, calls up Churchill and says, "It's over." And Churchill said, "How can it be? You got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over?" He said, "It's over." So I had that suppressed feeling. I can't be as wild as Carville, but he is damn smart, and I think he's damn right on this one.
Now, it has unfortunately become very low-hanging fruit to look at MSNBC's coverage of this primary for a sense of how out of touch, delusional, and frankly demoralized the Democratic establishment and its pundits are. But it really is something to behold.
It's obvious these other candidates have not sufficiently talked about him. It's obvious that he's never been vetted in the press. I've not seen the four-part series in the New York Times or the Washington Post or NBC News or anything else.
And then you have this shameless class of neocons, lifelong right-wing Republicans, so-called conservative pundits who call themselves the Never Trumpers. They have been in this weird alliance with the MSNBC DNC crowd in the 3 years of Donald Trump. And now they are all offering their unsolicited and unwanted panic-addled advice for what Democratic voters should do and how urgent it is that they stop Bernie Sanders.
This tweet from Never Trumper-in-Chief Bill Kristol, calling Democratic members of Congress, governors, and other leaders, could you perhaps say in public what you say in private, that a Sanders nomination would be a disaster for the party, and that were he to happen to win, his presidency would be bad for the country?
I'm sorry, but William Kristol, Max Boot, David Frum, all of these other neocons have no standing whatsoever to pretend to tell working people, people struggling for economic justice, racial justice, gender justice, against wars of aggression. They have no standing whatsoever to tell any of those people who they should be supporting in the race for the Democratic nomination. In fact, I would say that these people should not be able to go out in public without being asked repeatedly about their support for all of the civilian lives across the globe that have been lost because of the wars that they promoted and enabled. These people are dangerous charlatans, and it is shameful that some Democrats and media establishment figures so willingly ignored the atrocious careers of these people and embraced them as allies. These are, for the most part, Cold War armchair cowboys who do not have the best interests of the vast majority of Americans or the world at heart. They have spent their entire public lives on the wrong side of history.
As a United States Senator, I do understand the power of the corporate elite and the 1%. They have literally unlimited amounts of money. They have significant control over the media, over our economy, and over the political life of this country. But at the end of the day, the 1% is 1%.
Bernie Sanders has been in opposition his entire political career. He has run for election repeatedly, taken on major corporate and political forces. He has been vetted. The campaign of Hillary Clinton spent substantial resources on so-called opposition research against Bernie Sanders and produced absolutely nothing that could effectively tar Sanders. One of the wealthiest people on earth, Michael Bloomberg, is right now spending mega millions trying to smear Bernie Sanders. And it's a bit ironic and frankly nuts that Bloomberg, with all of his heinous, well-documented skeletons that are not in the closet but are literally walking around in public, for him to pretend to be the veteran-chief of Bernie Sanders? Here's the fact. If there was any real dirt, I mean consequential facts, about Bernie Sanders, they would have already been reported on, leaked, weaponized. And so what do we have now? Red baiting. This was predictable, and it was definitely part of the Clinton attack on Sanders back in the 2016 campaign.
Question you were asking Senator Sanders. I think in that same interview, he praised what he called the revolution of values in Cuba and talked about how people were working for the common good, not for themselves. I just couldn't disagree more. You know, if the values are that you oppress people, you disappear people, you imprison people, even kill people for expressing their opinions, for expressing freedom of speech, that is not the kind of revolution of values that I ever want to see.
Now, once again, this red baiting is emerging as a central tactic that is being used by Democratic Party elites and by Bloomberg, Joe Biden, yes, Pete Buttigieg, and by Republicans and Donald Trump to attack him. There is this alliance now between the GOP and the Democratic establishment to use red scare tactics against Bernie Sanders. This is the central strategy of the bipartisan coalition opposing Bernie Sanders, McCarthyism.
But the problem is, the real winner last night, I believe, was Putin. I mean, we're going to have the most divisive election. If Bernie is the nominee, we are going to see two very, very angry people representing two very different extremes of their parties. And I think that helps make America more chaotic. It makes us more divisive. And I think the one that gets advantaged by that is Russia.
You may not know it by watching major television networks these days, but Bernie Sanders does not go around the country campaigning against the murderous U.S. foreign policy of the 1960s, 70s, or 80s, or discussing Cuba's literacy program from the early 1960s. He's not wearing a Che Guevara t-shirt at his rallies. No, it's the corporate media, some of Sanders' Democratic opponents, and elite Democratic establishment figures, the Republicans, and journalists who are harping on these issues. Why are we talking about Cuba and its literacy program? Is it because Bernie Sanders is always referencing it in his campaign speeches and rallies? No, we're discussing it because that is what McCarthyite corporate power wants to discuss in a dishonest, out-of-context effort to smear Bernie Sanders. And by the way, isn't it interesting how these political forces are intensifying these attacks after Sanders' historic win in Nevada, which was propelled by the Latinx vote? Part of what is happening right now is most definitely an effort to weaponize Cuban Americans for partisan political smear purposes ahead of Super Tuesday, where large numbers of Latinx people will be voting. And by the way, the Cuban American community of today, including in Florida, is not the monolithic right-wing constituency that these attacks seem to assume it is. The truth is that the attacks on Sanders, on Cuba, Nicaragua, Latin America, Sanders' statements in the 70s suggesting the CIA should be abolished, these are meant to distract, and they are pathetic attacks. But if that's the debate they insist on having, then let's have a real, honest debate on the murderous U.S. policies that Sanders was opposing. I'm not saying that this would be a wise strategy for Bernie Sanders to engage in, to proactively raise these issues on the campaign. But if he's confronted with this intense, fact-free, ahistorical red-baiting, yes, he should talk about the actual history. There are much more urgent issues to address, and Sanders always pivots to those, as he should. But for those of us who are not running for president right now or working for political campaigns, for those of us for whom facts, context, and history matter, we should set the record straight in the face of these smears, of this attempt to revise history. Let's talk about Fulgencio Batista's vicious dictatorship in Cuba that was backed by the wealthy power elite inside the U.S. government and in the private sector. That was the government that Fidel Castro overthrew, and it is indisputable that the Cuban Revolution brought healthcare, housing, literacy, education to a country that had for decades been a U.S. plantation with a bunch of casinos on it. Let's talk about the vile U.S.-backed Contra death squads in Nicaragua and its campaign of terror, rape, pillage, murder, all supported by the Reagan administration. Let's talk about the coups and assassinations and support for dictators and brutal thugs orchestrated by the U.S. government for decades.
If you trace the history of the United States vis-a-vis Latin America and Central America, there has never been a time when a country made a revolution for the poor people where it was not overthrown by the CIA or the United States government or the Marines. Salvador Allende was democratically elected by the people of Chile. He made the mistake of believing that his job as president of that country was to represent the people of Chile. And he did his best, and he was overthrown by the CIA. So the interesting question is, why does the United States government think, whether it's Nicaragua or any other country in Latin or Central America, that it has the right to overthrow those governments?
Bernie Sanders came of age in an era where the CIA was being revealed publicly as a criminal enterprise, overthrowing governments, backing death squads, actively spying on American citizens, assassinating people. And you know what? Bernie Sanders had the courage in real time to oppose it when it mattered. You see, these cherry-picking, ahistorical, red-baiting attacks on Sanders that we are seeing from Bloomberg, Buttigieg, Biden, never-Trumpers, Democratic elites, media figures, it's propaganda. It's rooted in lies, and it is banking on ignorance of history. It's aimed at making voters scared of the red menace, and it's an effort to try to prosecute Sanders in front of their modern-day House Un-American Activities Committee.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the
that's
basic principles of Americanism.
That's not the question. The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Many of the dishonest scaremongering attacks are being made by people who never say a word against U.S.-backed dictators, despots, or death squads. For the most part, these forces are happy to get in bed with dictators and human rights abusers if it fits their political, or in the case of Mike Bloomberg, business interests. Bloomberg, not too long ago, was yucking it up with Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia enjoying a venti Starbucks as he stood next to a man who oversees one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world and murders journalists. Bloomberg makes a ton of money doing business with the Chinese Communist Party and its leaders. Joe Biden was a key player in the start of the genocidal Saudi bombing campaign in Yemen. Let's not even talk about any of their positions on Israel and the Palestinians. Here's the major difference between those attacking Sanders and Bernie Sanders himself. Sanders has consistently opposed U.S. hegemony. That's why they attack him. These people don't care about human rights unless it fits their agenda. If you actually listen to what Sanders has said about left-wing governments, he constantly offers nuance. He calls out authoritarianism and anti-democratic policies. Just compare Bernie Sanders' analysis of China with that of Mike Bloomberg, who makes tremendous money off of China. Here is Bloomberg.
Xi Jinping is not a dictator. He has to satisfy his constituents or he's not going to survive.
He's not a dictator?
No, he has to. He has a constituency to answer to.
He doesn't have a vote. He doesn't have a democracy.
And now here's Bernie Sanders.
I happen to believe in democracy, not authoritarianism. But, you know, you can't say China is another example. All right. China is an authoritarian country, becoming more and more authoritarian. But can anyone deny? I mean, the facts are clear. That they have taken more people out of extreme poverty than any country in history. Do I get criticized because I say that? That's the truth.
Bernie Sanders' crime that is inspiring these attacks against him is that he has the audacity to acknowledge the good that has come from popular revolutions that happen to be opposed to the politics of U.S. empire. And none, I mean none, of the people attacking him ever want to discuss context or the bloody role of the U.S. in these countries. That's the tripwire that Sanders crossed throughout his career that makes them hate him so much today.
There's this one thing that they did. And American voters don't understand nuance. They hear communism.
There's no way around that. This is as bad as you know who's saying they were good people on both sides. Yep. It's the same thing. There's no way to get...
I don't agree.
Oh, I do. Once you start saying, well, you know, Hitler wasn't so bad because
he didn't say that.
But no, he didn't say that. But to a Cuban person, it's just as bad.
I agree.
It's just as bad.
I don't endorse political candidates, and I do not think that Bernie Sanders is some sort of political savior. I have my disagreements with some of Sanders' policy and record. We've discussed some of those on this show. And by the way, there are a lot of leftists in this country who believe that Sanders is being too harsh in his condemnations of Cuba, or are opposed to Sanders' positions on, for instance, drone strikes and some U.S. wars. Bernie Sanders is not a revolutionary socialist. He's a democratic socialist. And with all that said, Bernie Sanders has proven himself since 2016 to be a great vehicle for change, certainly within the constraints and corruption of the U.S. electoral system. But both within and outside the electoral process, Bernie Sanders has made possible the building of an incredibly diverse, horizontal movement that could radically transform this country and the world for the better. And he's done it by lifting up the movements and people and communities who have been doing this work far longer than Sanders has been running for president. And that's the key.
Fast forward this campaign. Who is the only candidate to call to break up ICE and CBP? Senator Bernie Sanders. That matters. All of this matters. And when it comes to politics, you get what you pay for. And when you have candidates bankrolled by billionaires, who are they going to work for? Who do you think they're going to work for?
Bernie Sanders is an imperfect messenger, for sure. But he has done the work, kept focus, and inspired so many people across racial, economic, gender, and ethnic lines to fight for something bigger than themselves. Remember that when you watch the desperate smears against him. Remember that what they are really trying to stop has nothing to do with Fidel Castro or the Sandinistas or Bernie Sanders' honeymoon. This is about stopping the masses of people who are sick and tired of a system that is based on oppression and rooted in defense of a system where the rich and powerful rule all of our lives.
Jeremy Scahill from The Latest Intercepted. They have a bonus edition. And the other podcast they do, Deconstructed, is a rundown of the last debate, which again was on Mardi Gras. And it's more expensive to go to that debate than maybe rent a hotel right on Congo Square, or as close as you can get in the quarter. I forget exactly how much it was, but it was not affordable, which is curious for South Carolina. As I said, I'm a little behind. I think I'm catching up all right, maybe. A couple of announcements around town. Resist 4 art event, new venue at the 25 o'clock Brewing Company. That's down by that little parklet that was supposed to extend all the way to Crystal Lake Park from downtown, but things don't always go that way. Maybe eventually there'll be a greenway through there. Let's see, 2 to 7. There'll be some entertainment from Los Guapos, who have been playing out again. I don't have a time for that. It's probably towards the end of the segment. Maybe I'll try and get some more on that. Resist 4 artwork in opposition. Sunday, March 1st, 1 to 2:30. The Robert E. Brown Center for World Music is collaborating with the Capoeira Angola Center for a workshop on Afro-Brazilian percussion. I guess you can go and just listen. And let's see, the venue for that is the little center on the north side of Lincoln Square. And enter by the old post office, the IMC, to get there most proximately. Wednesday, March 4th, International Women's Day Photography Conference. The deadline for submission is already passed. And that's what this mainly is about. But 5:30 to 7 p.m., the Asian American Cultural Center on campus, 1210 West Nevada. Somebody's noting International Women's Day. The Y has an event on the 8th, the weekend. YMCA, I mentioned them because I spend a lot of time there with their Friday Forum, and I hope to get an announcement in on that. But I did mention I cobbled together election protection theft segment with two different segments from KPFA with Greg Pallas. It's going to be roughly an every other week thing. I think they're shooting for. There's so much going on. But the election, important. This is with the programmer Sabrina Jacobs. I don't know her. She worked with Flashpoints for a while. She has a show which occasionally gets posted to AudioPort. This is one from a bit ago, so I excerpted out his celebrating the win in Georgia, getting documents, Freedom of Information suit against the now governor of Georgia, and it'll include Chris Kobach, KKK, Chris Kobach from Kansas. I think they make that joke in here, so why don't we get to it and I'll see how we're doing for time. Greg Palast, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. His new book is going to be called, is it How Trump Stole the 2020 Election? Something like that.
So we exposed interstate crossing. The new gimmick is something called use it or lose it or purge by postcard. If you vote, if you fail to vote in two elections, or they say you failed to vote, their records are crap in all these states. They send you a postcard, and if you don't answer the postcard, yes, I live here, and you know, like return this postcard, you lose your vote. Now, only about 8% of people ever return these cards, and according to the census figures, the people that return the cards are almost all white suburban older people who are homeowners. They know that cards that are sent to the interstate never get to people. They go into apartment buildings. It's to young people who've moved to a dorm room down the hall, and they lose their vote. So that's the new gimmick. And one of the things, when I sued Brian Kemp, he turned over all the names of the people he said had moved away. A third of a million never ever moved away. They just, he just removed them. They didn't move. And you have to understand that gimmick is being used in Michigan, in Ohio, all over the country, another 20 states. So I'm hoping that exposing this gimmick, I've exposed others, that exposure, the truth has to make a difference. I have to believe that.
Absolutely. Well, your belief has brought you to this point and brought us to this point as a country. My next question to you, though, Greg Palast, veteran investigative reporter, is you're reporting on the periphery, so to speak, of mainstream media, right? Okay, we can go on and on about, you know, mainstream media is owned by, you know, six major conglomerates, et cetera, et cetera. But Al Jazeera on the periphery, The Guardian on the periphery, Salon to an extent on the periphery. You know, it's been 20 years of exposing this and having
and results. And Rolling Stone, which is the AARP rock and roll newsletter.
Exactly. Hey, I got my AARP application in.
Right.
I'm going to be a card toter real soon here.
So you get to Rolling Stone.
Hey, there you go. It's a free thing. It's free. So with that, why hasn't mainstream media here in the United States? This is about our country. This is about our so-called democracy. Why do you think they haven't picked up on this? Why do you think that they haven't? Are they completely under the control of establishment Democrats? Can you slice and dice that up for us?
I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, why can I report from England and BBC, where I am the mainstream news? When I reported these stories,
why not MSNBC? Why not CNN?
They were four. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been on MSNBC, but on Joy Reid's program a lot. In other words, as I've asked the producers there, what about the paleface hosts?
Hey.
So I'm going to say your question. We're on radio, so I'm just going to take a wild guess that you're a woman of color.
Yes, I am.
So I'm going to tell you something about the United States.
Okay.
From people of the paler persuasion that we know. Your story ain't getting on the news, baby. That ain't happening. They're not going to let you do it. Okay. In fact, I'm writing a new book called How Trump Stole 2020 in the chapter called Whiteout. Why can't I get my stories in America's white press? Okay. We have an apartheid news system. Okay. And they are not going to bring up race. It's, for example, you've got the New York Times actually, believe it or not, called me into work with them, but I saw how they work. Mm-hmm. Or not work, mm-hmm. You know, and you know, they talked about Ohio was purging voters and they said, oh, the voter list was wrong, and, you know, they don't bring up race. What are the color of the voters? Okay. Right. And I'm going to tell you the color of the voters, because I've been there and I've gone through the lists, and you'll see, like, in places like Florida, it's not difficult to find that, because it says BLA next to black voters' names on the voter registration form. And so, you know, they don't want to, they want to say the lists are wrong. Or like when I busted the story about this interstate cross-check purge program going after millions of people of color. Yes, the New York Times ran a story saying the list was flawed. No, it wasn't flawed. It was literally 100% wrong that people were voting double. 100% wrong, not 7 million double voting suspects. But what they didn't mention is the color of the people on that list. Right. You know, and they didn't mention the color of the people on the list. This is a problem. So you're getting the story, but without the real story. It's not everyone that's threatened by being purged from voter rolls. Look, the truth is, I've been covering this for 20 years, right. And I got to tell you right now, if they were purging people off country club lists at Mar-a-Lago, that would come to an end real super fast.
That's right.
You know what? When during the 2000 election, Bush versus Gore, and I uncovered the removal of tens of thousands of black men from the voter rolls, not one U.S. outlet covered that, except it was in a column, an opinion column in the New York Times by Bob Herbert, a black reporter, okay? It was in, you know, it was all throughout the African-American media. But what was on the U.S. news? That in Palm Beach, in Palm Beach, there was the butterfly ballot where people had trouble voting. And I went to Palm Beach. So it's all these, it was this crying story about a few rich people lost their vote when 29,000 ballots of black people were missing in Jacksonville. Tens of thousands of black men removed from the voter rolls. None of this reported. Only a couple white people in Palm Beach were crying because they had a ballot that they couldn't understand. That's what got covered again and again. So it's about, it's real simple. It's about race in America still. We can cry about Kobe Bryant, but take away his vote and you won't hear about it.
That's right. That's right. The next question is, I mean, even with Obama being elected twice, I mean, I call it an anomaly. I don't know what to call it, really. But 20 years ago, there wasn't Twitter. There wasn't black Twitter, right? There wasn't Facebook, right? There wasn't the opportunity for folks to really delve into other outlets for news, to get their news, to consume their news. Do you see that as being a hope for the future in regards to getting the word out, as opposed to, you know, 20 years ago, what you had to deal with and you know, going to the black press and the black press picking it up and it becoming an issue within the black community, within the Latino community? Do you see the there being hope as far as with social media being on the forefront of spreading information?
Totally. And that's one of the reasons why you found out about my material, everything.
That's right.
You know, by going through the net and by going through the Guardian and the Guardian USA website, which comes to America, which has more readers in America than in England, by the way.
Right.
And we are getting around the electronic Berlin Wall of the mainstream press. Right. And that is vital. We are getting the word out around them. That's how, you know, Bernie rose. That's how Obama rose, too. And right. They can't. They can't, and by the way, they can't steal all the votes all the time. Otherwise, I would just retire, which I should do anyway. But okay,
no,
but
no.
But I got to tell you, they steal about. In fact, we have a pretty good estimate. It's about 5.9 million votes in each presidential year. It's been pretty steady for the past few, and Obama just overwhelmed the steal. In fact, one of my co-authors of Rolling Stone, Bobby Kennedy, unlike me, has his BlackBerry number, so he called him up about this stuff. Now, Obama did not want to bring up the issue of vote suppression. We can have a debate about whether that was proper or not. And again, he was afraid. He was afraid it would be seen again, as the media does. It's a race issue.
Because it is a race issue. Yeah, it is a race issue. And Obama, you happen to be black. You're half black, but you happen to be black. You're getting up, you know, he got elected. He's been in the White House. You know, it's like representing black people. But all of a sudden, when it's inconvenient, you know, he wants to step back. You know, you look at the issue with Trayvon Martin, all the other racial issues that happened in the 8 years that he was in office, and he did not lift a finger to say something to definitively defend, you know, the plight of these black folks who got caught up in the system. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to question his strategy or not. That's not
my
job.
There is no strategy, Greg. Okay, sorry.
But my view is simple. Mm-hmm. Don't rely on elected officials. Take care of them. I sue elected officials. This is Greg Palast. I sue them. I expose them. I don't expect them to do the right thing. And by the way, that's in any party. And I hope, I do want to come back at some point, and because I do want to warn people that by the numbers, by the way, by the raw numbers in terms of votes, people purged and votes not counted, people not added to the voter rolls who attempted to register, there is no state which suppresses more votes than the state of California. No one is close. Georgia doesn't even come close to California.
Wow.
Alex Padilla is the Catherine Harris of California, and that's how Bernie Sanders lost 2016. 750,000 votes, if you're listening, Alex. Would you tell us what are in the 750,000 ballots you never counted in 2016? And by the way, the 750,000 ballots not counted is a number from his office. And so I want to tell people right now, please, 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 if you are a non-party preference voter, that's the weird term used in California for independent voter. If you are an NPP voter, you have to request a crossover Democratic Party ballot if you want to vote in that.
Sorry about that. I'll let you think about that. We're going to pick right up with a non-election protection segment because of the pledge drive out west. Got behind the news, and there is a fresh one. A little indisposed right now. So should have just enough time to get this on, I think. This is a segment from Flashpoints from this week that, we'll just get to it. It picks up right on the California vote, which is looming right after South Carolina. And so he's suing Attorney General out there.
Okay, so, you know, normally we have our little bump-up music in which we announce the election crimes bulletin. So I want to announce that I've busted a new crime wave in the state, which has suppresses the. It's really the vote suppression champ. You know, I mentioned that I want a huge federal case against Brian Kemp of Georgia, the guy who was Secretary of State running the election, in which he was running himself against Stacey Abrams, and how he stole that race. And a federal court just gave me a big win, which allows me to open up the files, not only Brian Kemp's files, but files of secretaries of state and all these other vote scammers all over the nation. We are now using federal law. It's a big win. And I just sent a threatening note to some guy named Alex Padilla, who says he's your Secretary of State in the state of California, which by the numbers, there is no state which comes close to California in suppression of the vote. Pure raw numbers, okay? And look out for this Super Tuesday primary. So I want to tell you how not to lose your vote, okay? This is very, very important. And in California, going back to 16, and Mrs. Clinton, okay, she supposedly won by a couple hundred thousand votes in California, not counting several hundred thousand votes. When I say not counting, California has the biggest non-count of votes in this entire nation. According to the Election Assistance Commission, of the 3 million ballots, provisional ballots, which are subject to challenge and rejection, of the 3 million ballots, provisional ballots cast in the United States, over half are cast in California. In the 16 primary, 8.6 Californians cast ballots in the primary, but there were only 7.3 million votes for President of the United States. Where are the missing votes, Mr. Padilla? He's been ducking and weaving and not getting back to me. So Today I just notified him that I'm calling in the attorneys that ripped Kemp apart, and we are going to unfortunately have to bring him to California. But I'm I do have a lot of information on what's happening.
Now there,
this
is a very important year for California and a presidential election right now.
California,
we're in the middle.
Yes. Okay. So California has 494 delegates. That's 1/4 of all the delegates you need to win the Democratic nomination. Basically, California can wrap it for Bernie or kill candidates. And by the way, there's another candidate at risk, Mike Bloomberg. I'll tell you about that in a second. The way Padilla and the Democratic National Committee run primaries in California, and here's the weird thing, in the California Constitution, it actually gives all authority for running primaries to the Democratic National Committee. And so the Democratic National Committee hates the 5 million Californians. There are 5 million Californians who register no party preference, NPP. Now, my dear friends, if you registered no party preference, or if you foolishly registered as independent because you thought that made you independent, that puts you in the independent party, okay? But if you're in the independent party, 500,000 of you, or you're one of the 5 million no party preference people, you have the right to vote in the Democratic Party. Now, the state's top voting statistician is a guy named Paul Mitchell, and he works with both political parties and the state of California. He's completely nonpartisan, but he has said that literally you're going to lose a million voters who have the right to vote in the Democratic Party primary, want to vote in the Democratic Party primary, but are going to lose their vote because they have no idea how to deal with the procedures. A million Californians are going to lose their right to vote and their votes, or their votes will be canceled, not tallied for president.
That's amazing.
How does this happen? It's insane. That's why I say California has is the vote suppression champ of the United States.
Right.
How does this happen? I want to tell you how to save your vote and spread the word. And I don't care who you're voting for, but I'm telling you how to save your vote. Okay, if you are one of the 5 million NPP voters or 500,000 independent voters, you need to fill out a crossover. You have to go into the polling station with your ballot and your envelope. God forbid, don't forget the envelope. Bring in your NPP or independent ballot into the voting center, as they call them now. Go into the voting center and say, here's the magic word, I want a crossover Democratic Party ballot. Now, under DNC rules enforced by Mr. Padilla, who, by the way, has been campaigning for Joe Biden. This is our guy running our elections, okay? According to Mr. Padilla and the DNC, you have to say the magic word crossover Democratic Party ballot, or you can't get the ballot. If you say Democratic Party ballot, they will tell you you may not vote in the Democratic primary. Or they may say you have to vote provisionally, in which case your ballot will be junked. You have to have the crossover ballot. So you have to say the magic word crossover. Most people don't know that. And some of the people behind the desk, they are not allowed by law to tell you If you walk and say, I want to vote for Bernie Sanders, I don't see him on my ballot. That's because you have an NPP ballot and you need the crossover. They can't tell you that. That's number one. Number two, a lot of you are mailing in your ballot. If you have, you have the right to ask for a Democratic Party crossover ballot in exchange for the NPP ballot you have. But that, your deadline is passed 2 days ago. So the only way you can vote for Sanders, or in fact, for, you know, Biden or Buttigieg or whoever you want, the only way you can do that is to go into the voting center and turn in that ballot. If you don't have your ballot with you, you can ask for the crossover Democratic Party ballot, and they'll put it in the provisional ballot envelope. And by the way, tens of thousands of people lose their vote because they forget to sign the provisional ballot envelope. It's quite a process. It's a trick. And who's the benefit? According to Paul Mitchell's data, Bernie Sanders is going to lose 400,000 votes this way. 400,000 voters are going to lose their votes who say they want to vote for Sanders. And so what he does, just so you understand, Paul Mitchell, who, again, works for both parties and the state of California, so he gathers all this information for everyone. He asked the voters who are NPP voters, 87% want to vote in the primary, 57% of the NPP voters actually want to vote in the Democratic primary. By the way, I don't know why anyone would ever register NPP. It just excludes you from the primary. Well,
Greg, I got to jump in here now because we're in a life and death mission. I don't have to tell you. We are looking forward to expanded election crimes bulletin. We know it's not just about Russia and the disappearing votes. We know that
Russia didn't make up the NPP vote for California.
No, they didn't, did they? People. They're not involved, are they? No.
So I'm going to tell people, I'm going to jump ahead of you. You're hearing Greg Palast, the election crimes bulletin, how they're going to steal it from Sanders, how Alex Padilla and the Democratic National Committee are trying to fix the vote in California for Biden. And by the way, Mitchell calculates that Bloomberg's going to lose 400,000 votes as well because he's a favorite of a lot of independents who want to vote but don't know how. So now you're not going to hear this on National Petroleum Radio. You're not going to hear this on the petroleum broadcast system, certainly not on Fox or CBS or any of those other corporate cesspools. You're going to hear it on KPFA and your Pacifica stations. And if you don't support this, you won't hear from Greg Palast. It goes dark. I mean, yeah, and you go, oh, well, you know, I'll listen to Democracy Now. Where are you going to get that, huh? So let me...
Greg Palast getting apoplectic there. Like I said, I was doing the pledge drive, so that wasn't a real election theft bulletin. I cobbled together two segments of his work. How Trump Stole the 2020 Election, that's his upcoming book. A couple of minutes left. I guess I accelerated that just a little too fast. I'm going to put some Laura Driscoll in the background. She did a great show with her CD release, Woven Dreams. She's going to be over in Bloomington next weekend at Upfront Jazz Place there. And for people listening west here and people that want to chase some jazz. Okay, I gave an announcement about the Resist at 25 o'clock starting in a couple of hours. Here's one. Tune into Women Making Waves this Sunday, March 1st from 1 to 3 to celebrate the first day of Women's History Month. They're spotlighting 2 hours of women's music every Sunday since 1981. This week at 2, join to hear from local women about special events happening through March, including celebration of the 100th anniversary of women getting the vote. Maybe equal rights is on the docket now. Art and theater that highlights women's history. So check that out between 2 and 4. And, oh, I didn't start this up in the background, did I? Just a couple of seconds left, and I had another announcement. Support your local media. Support WEPT. And oh, we get a bass solo. That's good to talk over a bass solo. Everybody seems to do it when you're out at the clubs. I'm a scold. I know I'm a scold. Well, you've heard the announcement about the WEFT transmitter at the top of the hour at the end of Aaron's show, but I'll just reprise a bit of that. At some point when the weather's permitting and the health of the crew climb that quarter-mile tower, I think, I'm going to put up a new feed line, a new, brand new, spanking new 600-pound transmitter. I mean, antenna. It'll be the same transmitter. Same locality over on Alta Vineyards area. Highest point in Champaign County. But there'll be an outage for a few days, then that will be online. You can find out information on the website by listening online. And After that, there'll be a low power while the contours of the signal see if the directionality of the antenna is working right to protect that lovely station in Covington, Indiana. And it's straight up 1 o'clock, fresh behind the news.